but is, I think, a useful way of thinking about pushing the boundaries of our knowledge in a new direction. So the general theme is often referred to as looking for portals beyond the standard model. Thinking about those portals. And I'm going to try to do three things in this lecture if I have time. The first is just to explain what this framework is. And then I'll talk in a little bit more detail about two portals, so-called scalar portal and vector portal. Okay. Before I do that, I just want to set the scene by asking a very general, although not very modest, question. What are the forces of nature, and what's the particle content of the universe? Now, clearly, if I can't build a Planck scale collider, those questions are above my pay grade. But the very least I can do is try to just ask that question for the sort of old established world energy scales that we've probed, masses below, say, half the Z mass. Okay, what is the particle content? What are the forces of nature? So we obviously know the standard model is a part of that. And we can ask, well, could there be other particle content below half the Z mass? And you can actually say on pretty general grounds that if those particles are charged under the standard model in any way, they cannot be. There is not room for light particles charged under the standard model. So for example, this isn't really the portals, this is the prequel to the portals. For example, if I think about a charged particle lighter than half the Z mass, it would be copiously produced at LEP and at the LHC. Now, would you find it? Well, if it was substantially produced in the Z decays, it would affect its total width. If it was stable, you'd see some semi-relativistic particle, new particle going through your tracker. If it was unstable, then the decays would be observable. The same is true, by the way, for just a neutral piece of a weak doublet or any weak multiplet, that things like the Z-pole would give you a good handle on such particles if they exist. In the case of colored particles, it's less obvious because we don't have necessarily a precision approach to them through lepton colliders. But it's actually still true that a colored particle below about half the Z mass can be constrained by the way it changed the running of the strong coupling at LEP. So this has been very well measured, and there's basically no room for strongly interacting particles below half the Z mass. So it seems like this is a pretty solved problem. There's no new matter below half the Z mass. And adding new, one question you could ask is, well, what if that particle was colored, but it also had some new interactions? Could that change things? And the answer is no, it actually makes all of these arguments worse. Because from the point of view of the standard model, let's say I added a new SU2 and I added a particle that was a doublet under that SU2. Well, as far as the running of alpha S cares, that's just adding two particles. That's worse than adding one. So you can't really change any of this by adding extra interactions. For these light particles, we can say pretty robustly that there are no light particles in nature charged under the standard model. But there is not a comparably general argument at all for neutral particles. That is, particles that are neutral under the weak, strong, and electromagnetic interactions. In fact, generally you'd expect that such particles are hard to see. Okay, and why is that? Well, actually it just follows from dimensional analysis. So if I consider, for example, a particle, some new fermion psi, and I'll say that it's charged under some new U1, for example, then the leading interactions I could write down to couple it to the standard model would be things, for example, I could couple a current of psi, that's going to be neutral under the new U1, to it's a bar, to a Q bar, gamma mu Q, say. This is a fermion, this is a fermion, so this whole operator has dimension 6. In my Lagrangian, it would appear with a mass dimension minus 2 coupling. Now, how visible this particle is depends on what the scale is. Okay? There are other examples where we can write down interactions of this type within the standard model, dimension 6 operators, that we can write down, and yet the observed size of those, the bounds on that size, are extremely low. Okay, so in other words, the bounds on this, the lower bounds on this scale are very high mass scales. The best example of that is probably proton decay. Consistent with all the symmetries of the standard model, you can write down a proton decay operator. But this coupling has to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to the 15. The scale has to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to the 15 GeV or higher, consistent with data. There are similar, although slightly weaker, constraints for dimension 6 operators in the standard model that violate flavor. So it's reasonable to think that any interaction like this might also be suppressed by a very high mass scale. And in that case, if you wanted to produce this new particle, you're not going to do it through the Z. You're not going to do it through the strong interactions because it's neutral. The only way you could hope to produce it is through this operator. But that leads to a cross section that's going to go like energy squared over lambda to the fourth. So if the scale lambda is large, then the cross section is very small. So such physics might be hard to see, but it's also hard to deal with theoretically, because what I've said is I want to think about all possible physics that's neutral under the standard model, but might have other interactions, and then you just try to enumerate that. And so, you know, how do you do that? Now, yesterday somebody asked me, what were some examples? I think you asked me. What are some examples of physics that would be too crazy for me to talk about in these lectures? Now, of course, by definition, if it's too crazy for me to talk about it, then I'm not going to talk about it. But, all right, I have a friend. Now, you know, usually when people talk about, I start something confessional with I have a friend, they're really talking about themselves. But I really have a friend. See, that's his picture. And this friend of mine is willing to tell a story that I myself am not willing to tell. The picture might be cut off, but don't worry about it. I mainly have this for the audio. So this is Neil Weiner at a recent PI conference. And, Neil Weiner's going to tell a story.
I want to introduce a character that I like to call Professor Dark Matter. So when we start talking about, there is a division in the field about people who want to think about dark matter that has these dark forces and these excited states and all of these things. It's not for everybody. And the way I like to put it in perspective is to imagine this character, Professor Dark Matter. Professor Dark Matter is an assistant faculty at some major dark university, and she's coming up for tenure, and around that time they do some dark CMB test with the neutrinos, and they discover that approximately 4% of the universe is made out of something else, okay? Some weird other stuff, okay? Most of the universe is made out of dark matter, but there's a little bit of this other stuff out there. So she says, okay, I've got a theory for this. Here's my theory of that 4% of the universe. I'm going to take SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. I'm going to confine the SU3 at a scale around a GeV. I'm going to Higgs down the SU2 cross U1 at a scale about 100 GeV. Don't know why those scales are the same, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to take 3 generations of quarks and leptons. That's going to cancel my anomalies. I'm going to have a Higgs boson. It's going to do some of the work. I'm going to have neutrino masses and a phase in the secant matrix, but that's not going to be enough to actually explain why I have baryons and not anti-baryons. I'm going to take those composite states that come out of the combined SU3. I'm going to combine them with some of the residual particles that come about, which are charged under the residual U1. Those two things will come together and make a composite object. I'm going to build up big clumpy ones out of the colored stuff or the strongly interacting stuff. Those things then are going to build up all sorts of complicated structure. And that is my theory of the 4% of the universe. Okay? And and you just know she doesn't get tenure, right? They say, you're crazy. What are you talking about? It's a single particle with a single force, some simple composite state bouncing off each other. That's why you see little differences. That's it. It's crazy.
All right. So there's an example of a theory that I'm not crazy enough to talk about, although apparently Michael is. And now, slightly more seriously, we can do the same thing. We have a larger fraction of the universe to explain, and we could totally explain it with some very complicated, detailed model of exactly what happens in the dark sector that is as complex as the standard model, and we can put in that much detail, right? And any one of you could write a paper like this, and you could all write different papers like this. And if you did, honestly, I probably wouldn't vote for your tenure either. The reason is that for all of your 40 different papers, there would probably be about 3 or 4 different classes. Basically, I could divide you into 3 or 4 groups where your 40 different papers had exactly the same phenomenology section, okay? Which means that by proposing this detailed model of the SU4 cross SU2 cross SU2 dark sector that explains dark matter, or your SU5 cross SU3 dark sector that explains dark matter, you're not really advancing our understanding of nature. You're just showing off your ability to construct representations of a different Lie group. So that's the real question that we face here if we want to think about exotic physics, is how do you constructively organize this question into something that's relevant to experiment and tractable? Okay? So let's start with what we know about what can't be beyond the standard model. And I'm going to include here both things that could be dark matter and things that are just unstable. So one thing we know is that they can't have some crazy number of light degrees of freedom that are messing up the total entropy of the universe at Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And we know that there can't be particles that are produced in this dark sector copiously with a long-lived decay to the standard model. Okay? And there may be a couple other cosmological constraints like that. Well, and you can't produce a larger density of stable particles than what we see in dark matter. So there's some maximum density of stable particles. There's some maximum density of long-lived particles. And there's some maximum density of massless degrees of freedom. At BBN. And those are three basic and it's sometimes important constraints. But that's also a very coarse-grained view of the rest of nature. So the strategy, I think, instead, has to be premised on looking for exceptions to this rule I just told you. Okay, so I said most kinds of new particle could be hiding out there and invisible to our experiments because the only interactions they have are these dimension 6 operators. All right, well, you know how to try to get around that. Let's try to find some kinds of particles, some possibilities for the dark sector that maybe we could couple to with a lower dimension operator. And then we might actually have a shot in hell of finding those. Okay, so that's one way to organize our thinking. And it's very straightforward because it's totally dictated by standard model symmetries. Okay, so what we want Now I'm finally getting to the portals. What we want is interactions of dimension less than four, less of dimension less than or equal to four, coupling standard model particles to standard model neutral particles. And these are going to be interactions that appear in my Lagrangian, so they should be gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant. Now, I don't know what the symmetries of my dark sector are, so I'm not going to assume anything about what's going on here, but we know a lot about the symmetries of the standard model. And if I'm going to have an interaction of dimension less than or equal to 4 with a field of mass dimension in the dark sector, a combination of fields, with minimum mass dimension of 1, right? That's the lowest I'm ever going to get. Then I better start from standard model operators that aren't necessarily gauge invariant, that aren't necessarily Lorentz invariant by themselves, but are at the very least gauge invariant and of dimension less than or equal to 3. So what can I write down? Well, I have at dimension 2, I can write down Higgs dagger Higgs, make that singlet combination. At dimension 2, I have to build things out of two bosons, right? And there's no singlets in the standard model, so I'm not going to consider things involving one scalar or one boson, but I can build things out of bosons that have dimension 2. In terms of gauge bosons, well, you know that the only gauge invariants you can build out of gauge bosons involve things like F mu nu. In fact, for hypercharge, let's call that B mu nu, that by itself, that field strength is gauge invariant. For the non-abelian parts of the standard model, the analogous field strengths aren't gauge invariant. They still transform as an adjoint under whatever group. And so to build a Lorentz invariant out of them, I'd have to build field strength times field strength. That's dimension 4. I'm not interested in it. So this is it at dimension 2. At dimension 3, there's two more things that I can do. One operator that we know and love is basically the kind of thing we build symmetry currents out of. So I can take, for example, an F bar d mu f, d slash f for some fermion f of the standard model. That's invariant. I didn't mean that. Good. I meant gamma mu f. That's dimension 3 as advertised. And I can build, the other thing that I can do is I can take a Higgs and a lepton field, contract their SU2 indices together. Thank you. That is 2.5. Good. Okay. I can add. Fantastic. And this is it. This is all we can write down. So now we can ask, well, what kinds of, beyond the standard model, can I multiply each of these by? Now they're gauge invariant. I want to build something that's also Lorentz invariant. So if there is a neutral scalar in the dark sector, then I could just multiply this by that single scalar field and get a dimension 3 operator. If there was a charge scalar out there that's neutral under the standard model, it could have any types of charges you want. I could also multiply it by that phi squared, and that would give you some dimension 4 interaction. This one, if I have some new U1, so basically this couples to new scalars, if I have a new U1 field, then I could do I can couple to the analogous field strength in the dark sector. So I'll call its field strength F prime mu nu. This one, I can make gauge invariant Well, this one's sort of a little bit, you know, it's unclear how you want to count it. You can think about coupling this to a new gauge boson V mu. That's precisely the kind of interaction that you would get if you were really gauging a new charge out of the standard model. So for example, if I wanted to gauge baryon minus lepton number, I would take the sum of these currents that makes up the baryon minus lepton number current, couple that to V mu, and there exists a reassignment of standard model charges such that this is gauge invariant. So that's fine, but it's sort of, it's more like gauging a global symmetry of the standard model. And this one was a new U1, where here I don't need to change what I mean by the standard model charges. This is still gauge invariant. And lastly, in this case, if I have a totally singlet scalar, sorry, a totally singlet fermion, then I can contract the spinner index of this object with a spinner index of my scalar fermion. That would just give me the Dirac neutrino mass operator. So this is for a new neutral, new singlet fermion. Okay, each of these three have a name. This is called the scalar portal. This is called the neutrino portal. And this is called either the vector portal or kinetic mixing. Any one of these gives us a framework for thinking about new ways of producing, new ways of exploring that other sector. Now, some of them are very constrained by current data. Some of them aren't very constrained at all. You might think, well, this neutrino portal, you know, it's coupling things to Higgses. Those are hard to produce. We're just beginning to study them. And it's coupling them to neutrinos. Maybe that's not very constrained. Maybe we can use that interaction to think about new ways of producing that dark sector. For example, we could go through a Higgs decay to a lepton or to a neutrino and this N. And then who knows what other interactions N might have, right? N could couple to some other fermions that are charged and that scalars that, you know, some psi and phi that do more interesting things, and this would be a new way to produce them through Higgs decay. Or I could even think about using this to produce to produce these new particles through a neutrino scattering process. So I could have a neutrino get excited through a charge current interaction with a nucleus, and then mix through that interaction with this N and go to psi phi. The problem is that, well, okay, if N is just a singlet that only interacts with the neutrino, and this operator was the only coupling of N to anybody else, then we know that's just a Dirac neutrino. We know the coupling is incredibly small, and we're done. Suppose that's not the case. In other words, suppose that N is part of what gives the neutrino a Majorana mass. Then we still have, for light masses of the singlet N, we still have very tight constraints on the coefficient of this operator. So actually, just very quickly, I want to go back. I'll leave this up here. So I'll consider the operator epsilon HLN. I can get good constraints on epsilon just from the fact that integrating out n would give me a neutrino mass, a contribution to the neutrino Majorana mass that goes like epsilon squared v squared over the mass of the n. And if I want this to be about 0.1 eV, then epsilon has to be less than about 10 to the minus 7 for mn of a GeV. And it goes like mn to the 1/2. So even for weak scale n's, this coupling would actually have to be very small, which means the rates for all of these processes are going to be very small. So those would be rare. The neutrino portal is mainly interesting for its possible influence on neutrino masses, but by the time you get those to a reasonable scale, this physics is actually quite limited. Now, what about the other portals and their physics? I'm going to talk now a little bit about the scalar portal and then more about the vector portal once I'm done. So let me again, enough of that simple bit. So let's again think about, go ahead.
Is there a reason why you're ignoring the third possibility that you mentioned?
The global symmetry.
Yeah.
I only have an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
We will come back to the vector portal and a lot of the physics of testing. In the case where this new gauge boson is light, a lot of the physics is similar to that of the kinetic mixing case. So many of the same experiments test both. In the case of a heavy Z prime coupled to B minus L or some other standard model symmetry, that's another very good thing to search for at high energies. And it's just beyond the scope of this lecture. There are interesting cases where interesting substantive differences between experimental sensitivity to that type of gauge boson and the kinetically mixed gauge boson. And so it is important to think about both. My own personal bias is that if we're going to think about very light particles, and I'll justify this in a bit. If we're going to think about light gauge bosons, then for consistency, we always have to think about very small couplings. And those very small couplings arise quite naturally in the kinetic mixing setup and always have felt a little more ad hoc in this context. Which doesn't mean that we should completely ignore them because there's ad hoc, seemingly ad hoc standard small numbers all over the standard model. But in choosing what to cover, I did decide to leave them out. Except for those few comments, which I would have forgotten unless you asked. So thanks, because I did want to make them. So good. So I'm just going to skip to the scalar briefly, then the vector. So let's consider. Let's see. Do I want to do a charged scalar or a neutral scalar? I think for simplicity, I'll talk about let me start with a neutral scalar. So I'm going to add, obviously, a kinetic term for my new neutral scalar. And then I'm going to add a potential. I'm going to assume that I have a neutral scalar, but with a Z2 symmetry. So I'm only going to write down even powers of the scalar. I'll add a quartic coupling, and I'm going to add this mixing with the Higgs. Now, the Z2 symmetry doesn't matter very much to anything that I'm going to say. The reason is that depending on, so what's going to happen, this mass term could be positive or negative. After electroweak symmetry breaking, that epsilon also contributes a mass term. That could be positive or negative. So I can spontaneously, S may or may not get a BEV. If S gets a BEV, then I've spontaneously broken the Z2 symmetry, and I have exactly the same types of terms that I would have, additional terms that I would have written down if I didn't impose the Z2 symmetry to begin with. If I had a charged scalar, I would again write down these same operators, except with absolute values. And as long as the global symmetry, as long as that symmetry was either under which it was charged, is either gauged and spontaneously broken, is either gauged or approximate. Gauged and spontaneously broken or an approximate symmetry, then there would be very little change to what I'm about to tell you. So let's say that I have this basic Lagrangian, and maybe this term, so what does this term give me? Minimally, with or without symmetry breaking, this is going to give me a decay mode through the Higgs BEV for a Higgs going to two scalars. So minimally, this gives me an exotic Higgs decay. And since I don't know really whether this is a broken or an unbroken Z2, whether this is a whether I'm dealing with a charged or a neutral scalar, let me just talk about what happens, what the relevant mixing terms are. In an effective theory, after electroweak symmetry breaking and any possible BEV that S might get. Okay? So if S had been, if I hadn't imposed the Z2, I would have generically written down some linear terms in S, cubic terms in S, and then you would definitely expect S to get a BEV. Even with the Z2, S might get a BEV. I'm not going to, once I expand about that potential, the potential about whatever that S BEV is, I'm going to have a potential that starts with some quartic term for S, some quadratic term for S. And then I'll keep track of the mixing terms as well. So this kind of mixing, so I'll still have some, so this is going to give me, so I'm going to have S squared. Let me actually call, am I being consistent? No. Let me call the Higgs doublet actually a capital H so that I can say that after electroweak symmetry breaking, I'm going to have a physical real Higgs degree of freedom that's just H is the real Higgs. So I used bad notation, because if I follow my notation over there, I have nothing left to call the physical Higgs. So I'll have this term with some dimensionful prefactor after electroweak symmetry breaking. This is, of course, just epsilon V in the example above. I can also have linear terms, mixing terms. Call the coefficient B times SH. And then I could also have higher order terms, for example, this original epsilon S squared H squared. But these first three are actually the things that'll really matter to me. So this is the one that gives Higgs decays. This term induces mixing. between the Higgs and S.
So I can have Higgs singlet mixing. And let's say the mixing angle is some theta S. Those are the two consequences of the mixing. And then the third thing that'll impact what I see is, of course, the mass of S. So is this, sorry, is this setup clear? I've sort of, I introduced a model, but then I'm not actually using the details of this model very much. But the important thing is that these are the two types of interaction of the scalar and new scalar and the Higgs that can be important after electric weak symmetry breaking and after potential dark sector symmetry breaking. So what does Higgs singlet mixing do? Well, if there was one thing it does is it gives this singlet avenues to decay. So it lets us, for example, consider singlets to FF bar. But before I consider singlet decays, we should probably think about how the singlet is produced. Well, produced through Higgs decays. That's one thing. Because the Higgs has a very small width, even small values of this mixing, mu, can lead to pretty noticeable deformations of Higgs properties. So for example, if I had mu of order 0.01 times v, so in other words, this is epsilon, the model I gave, that would be epsilon, that would give about a 10% branching ratio for Higgs to singlet. That's certainly big enough to be potentially detectable. If the singlet was exactly stable, then this would just be an invisible Higgs decay mode, which hasn't been constrained at the 10% level. If the singlet decayed into some other particles of the dark sector, then you might get, you know, there's a lot of possibilities that one can enumerate. Simplest other case to consider is that the singlet is not exact, does have this Higgs mixing, and that minimally opens up this type of decay. Now the width for this decay, since it's just coming through Higgs mixing, is very closely related to the widths for the standard model Higgs's decay. So in this case, there would be a sine squared theta s, the mixing, times some factors that you could just copy out of standard model Higgs notes. Number of colors for f over 8 pi times the mass of that fermion squared over v squared. Then there's some some phase space factor dependent on the mass of that fermion. And finally, to get something dimensionally correct, the mass of the scalar. Okay, sorry, I'm writing this far in the corner. This beta f is equal to square root of 1 minus 4 f squared, mf squared, over ms squared. And so in this formula, this is all standard model-like. Those two just depend on the mass of the scalar, and this depends on the mixing. And those factors, those first two factors, the sine squared theta and the mass, those are universal. So the branching ratios are really just set by standard model properties. What sine squared theta affects, and also the mass, is whether this particle is going to be long-lived or short. It affects the total lifetime.
right? So in the limit of very small sine theta, and it's actually a good exercise to work out for a couple of different masses what sine theta you would need for this particle to be long-lived, say to live a centimeter before decaying. The reason that depends on masses is that if S is heavy enough to decay, say, to B quarks, then you're going to have a B mass in the rest of the formula that dominates. If S was just 5 or 10 MeV in mass, then the only thing it can decay to is electrons, and instead of a B quark mass of 5 GeV, you have an electron mass of half an MeV appearing in that width. So the lifetimes for a given mixing angle are obviously going to be a lot longer. So this is something that one can search for in exotic Higgs decays. Depending on the mass, you might look, for example, for decays of a Higgs to two pairs of B quarks, where those two pairs of B quarks carry the same mass. Or as you get lighter, it might be easier to actually look for a BB bar pair and a tau tau bar pair. As you get lighter, you can be dominated by decays to charm quarks and to muons. So you'd look for different signals of all of those. Now, the other thing that one can do, especially in this case of Higgs singlet mixing, is there are some low energy constraints. The strongest of those are actually from the decays of upsilon resonances. So upsilon is a BB bar resonance. And so it can decay. The 1s state in particular is long-lived. It has only, because it's the lightest BB bar resonance. So it decays basically dominantly through different modes of B quark annihilation. In fact, so one possibility is that you could have upsilon decay to the scalar S through its Higgs mixing and a photon. And this is something that's actually been searched for by several of the B factory experiments. Looking in particular as one example relevant for a few GeV mass ranges. This is obviously only relevant if MS is less than the mass of the upsilon, which is around 10 GeV. So in most of that mass range, the S would be able to and would dominantly decay to tau tau bar, tau plus tau minus. So this is a mode. This gamma tau plus tau minus with a resonance is something that's been looked for at B factories. And the branching ratio has to be less than about 10 to the minus 5 from these searches. So how do we figure out from that what the limit is on,
Wait, they're assuming that the mass is right between the tau mass, the twice the tau mass and twice the log mass. Isn't that a very particular choice of the MS value?
Well, so that's, for this particular search you are, so that's anything between 3 and, so if you're below 10 GeV, but of a GeV scale, then 3 to 10 GeV is a reasonably large fraction of that. But it is an assumption, absolutely. So there are other searches for mu mu, et cetera. And actually, the mu mu, the sensitivity isn't that different for those. I just had to pick one example to be concrete. So yeah, I mean, importantly, if you're producing this S on shell, it doesn't matter how small that width is, as long as it's prompt, you're still going to see that singlet. You're still going to get a rate for this process that is totally independent of how the singlet decays, right, or how narrow it is. So the calculation that I'm going to sketch out for you for what this branching ratio means applies equally well below the tau threshold when you're decaying to muons or even decaying to electrons. It's just that then you'd have to actually look up different analyses to get the limits.
However, and, of course, the restriction to a mass less than 9.5 GeV is very severe.
Yeah.
Above that, there's nothing.
Yes. So above that, the only constraints you can derive are basically, you can infer some constraints. The Higgs mixing can't be too large. Otherwise, it would have changed Higgs properties dramatically. But that's about it.
How does the gamma help you in the event?
How does what? The gamma?
Yeah.
Sorry. So I'm thinking here about an E plus about, sorry. Good. Basically it helps me because if I were to, so I can think of the epsilon as having two B quarks in them that annihilate, but with a fixed center of mass energy, right? So I can contrast two cases, again, assuming the singlet is less than the epsilon mass. In this case, my cross section, I'm producing a singlet on shell, right? And as long as the singlet mass is less than 10 GeV, I can produce it on shell through this process by emitting a gamma. If I didn't emit the gamma, then the whole center of mass energy of that epsilon, 10 GeV, would go through that resonance. So I'd actually be dealing with an off-shell singlet. Now that matters because this coupling here and both of these couplings here are fairly small. Even if the mixing angle was big, this would still be a small mass just because the tau u kappa, a small coupling just because the tau u kappa is small. So the reason I've added the gamma is so that I can think about an on-shell singlet. Also, by the way, by looking for the on-shell final state, I'm allowing myself to use an additional signature, not just measuring the total tau tau bar rate. Okay, this is actually, there's a much larger contribution to the tau tau bar final state coming from an intermediate photon. Here, I would be looking for a tau tau bar pair at a particular invariant mass associated with the photon. And so I can get better sensitivity to that invariant mass signal than I could to a continuum signal. So it's both the rate is larger on shell and the signal is more distinctive on shell. And this is not like an LHC collision where you're really sampling a whole bunch of center of mass energies. Morally allowing, considering the radiation of gammas isn't that different from considering PDFs. It's just the strongly coupled version. But in this case, it's very useful because it's weakly coupled, it's useful to think about just emitting one gamma at a time. So actually, right, so given this process, what I want to do is learn something about the couplings from that branching ratio. And to do that, it's useful to compare it to some other standard model process. So I mentioned tau tau bar and actually general lepton processes. There's another epsilon decay mode going through, dominated by a photon, to any pair of charged leptons. And this has a branching ratio of about 2.5%. And the kinematics is pretty similar. In both cases, the propagators are carrying around 10 GeV. So I can just say that the branching ratio for gamma S over the branching ratio for L plus L minus should be roughly equal to the ratio of the product of couplings. Couplings here to couplings here. So in the gamma singlet case, well, this vertex just has an electric charge. And the second vertex is going to have this sine of theta mixing times the Yukawa quark, times the bottom Yukawa. And that's about 0.02. For the L plus L minus, each of these couplings is just electron. That's just an electric QED vertex, I mean. So the ratio would just be to E squared. And now, using this, and using the fact that this branching ratio has to be less than 10 to the minus 5 over 0.025, I can infer a bound on sine theta s. If I want the branching ratios, I need to square the amplitude. So I needed to square that. That implies that sine squared of theta s has to be less than about 0.1. Or sine theta s less than about 0.4. So these are actually, you know, even though that branching ratio limit is quite sensitive, it's only really starting to probe interesting mixing angles with the Higgs. It's actually not that competitive. Well, it's probing theta x directly rather than mu. So it is probing something different. But you can imagine getting much better sensitivity to the same kinds of models through looking at Higgs decays. So that was all I wanted to say about Scalar Portal. But I'll leave this board down for a while. So let's move on to the vector portal. I actually had a lot I wanted to say about the vector portal. So since I might run out of time, let me start with this comment I made earlier in answer to one of the questions about the characteristic size of that kinetic mixing term. So if I want to consider that kind of interaction, how big of an epsilon should I think about? Now, of course, I don't know. This is just some Lagrangian parameter. It's logically consistent for epsilon to be order 1, just some bare parameter that I set by hand, just like, you know, all the other couplings of the standard model. So that's okay. It's fairly experimentally constrained, as you'll learn from that. At least for masses, I haven't talked about the mass of this guy at all yet. For masses that are below, you know, TeV scale, or this is quite, epsilon of order 1 is quite constrained. But, so why might it not be order 1? Well, it might not be order 1 if there's some symmetry at high scales that's spontaneously broken, but that at high scales sets epsilon to 0. A good example of why of a symmetry that might set it to 0 at high scales is a grand unification. Because in a gut, you actually need to embed B mu nu as part of, say, in an SU5 gut, as part of some SU5 field strength. Other way, as some part of some SU5 mu nu. And this is going to carry an SU5 adjoint index. It's not gauge invariant anymore. So the analogous operator, mixing F prime with this SU5 F mu nu, that would not be gauge invariant. That is therefore forbidden by symmetry. Now the gut's broken, okay, or whatever symmetry is protecting it is broken. At some high scale, there's still a lot of room for other physics, but in particular perturbative physics, to generate a non-zero epsilon. So to generate epsilon, all we have to consider is loops of one particle, one charged particle, that has a coupling to both hypercharge and this new gauge boson. I'll call A prime. Say this is G dark, and this here is G1. And I'm just going to introduce one fermion sign that couples to it. Now I can set up this loop integral. Okay, I'm going to have a trace for my fermion. I have a gamma mu at each vertex. So if this is a mu, this is a nu. I'd have a gamma mu from that loop diagram, and then I'm going to have some propagator. So that's got a loop momentum L. That's carrying momentum P. I can give this one L plus P over 2. This one L minus P over 2. slash gamma nu L minus P over 2 slash over my plus M psi plus M psi And what I want to look for this kinetic term, which has two powers of the photon moment of the photon momentum in it. So that tells me that I'm going to be looking at terms. Think about it roughly as pulling out these P slash terms in order to have enough momenta to generate to contribute to the operator F mu nu B mu nu, right? Because that has two derivatives in it. Okay, well, that's going to look like now some integral, if I think about low momentum, low p relative to this mass scale, d4l over 2 pi to the fourth times some algebra, some trace algebra coefficients times a 1 over l squared minus m psi squared squared. And this is just a straight logarithmic integral. It's going to give me some finite piece. This is where having Henley. Will that work? Okay. Yeah. I just want a little bit more space to the right. Finite piece. Plus a log m over lambda, all multiplied by a characteristic scale. I left off my couplings up there. That wasn't good. Of g1 g dark over 16 pi squared. So depending on these masses, this is the mass of the psi. And depending on the size of those couplings, this could be in the neighborhood of, say, 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3. Now, actually, in an exact gut, I still wouldn't be able to do this. And why is that? Well, let's consider, it's because this thing is linear in G1. I assumed that my psi had unit charge. But really, if I'm thinking about, say, a 5 of SU5, I should think about a triplet with charge 1/3 and a doublet with charge minus 1/2, all contributing to that loop diagram. And the triplet is going to give me terms that go like g1, g dark times 1/3 over 16 pi squared times the stuff I didn't calculate. And it's going to give me 3 of those because there are 3 particles. The doublet is going to give me 2 contributions from 2 particles of size minus 1/2 times that same factor. And so this is going to give me still 0 at one loop for a gut multiplet. And so there's 2 things that I can get. Basically what this is saying is that I still haven't introduced anything into my theory that breaks the grand unified symmetry that forbade this effect to begin with. So I need to put in gut breaking, and gut breaking can come in 2 different ways. One way that it can come in is I can just put explicit two-loop contributions, where now these particles in the loop, because they're in some non-trivial gut multiplet, they interact with all the gauge bosons of the gut. Then in particular, they interact with the X and Y bosons, which are heavy, and they interact with the standard model gauge bosons, which are light. And so that mass splitting, the fact that the X and Y are heavy, I'm integrating them out, the photons aren't, that's going to give me an epsilon and two-loop level. The other effect is that gut breaking will split this multiply, and I had these logs inside the parentheses. So actually, if the masses of the triplet and the doublet were different, then I would get something that looks like my original one loop breaking times a log of that doublet triplet mass splitting. Okay, so this kind of effect tends to be smaller, at least if I'm talking about, in many cases, this log, this mass splitting would also be loop suppressed by a loop factor. This tends to give me epsilons that are a little smaller, around 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 3. So those are reasonable scales to think about during Matt's lecture. Anything from order 1 down to here. Now, of course, I can also think about smaller epsilons. I can imagine situations where, well, the simplest thing I can do is say, okay, fine, maybe both, if one of my U1s is in a gut, why don't I consider both of the U1s being in a gut? And then I'm going to have to include two separate guts, right? So the standard model U1 is in SU5, and the other U1 is in some SU6. I don't know. Then I would need to go to 3 loops, and I'd get even smaller epsilons, another factor of order 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3. So that's one scenario where you'd think about smaller epsilons. Another scenario where you can think about even much, much smaller epsilons is that maybe there are no particles, heavy particles, that are charged under both like this, but there's still non-perturbative effects that generate this mixing. And so then we're talking about something exponentially small. So those are just a few scales to keep in mind. Now, what I'd like to do with the remainder of the lecture is tell you how to think about what this kinetic mixing actually does in a couple of different regimes. And I want to do that in a toy model first, with no weak interactions. Because thinking about it in the toy model will also make clear how to think about it in the full standard model a little bit more simply than just doing 3x3 matrix algebra. We do 3x3 matrix algebra when we have to, like when we have 3 generations, but it's best to avoid it when you can. So, good. So let's consider a Lagrangian. I'm just going to take QED. So I have my electron. I'm going to use psi for the electron now. So I have some psi bar d/-ie a/psi. I'll have my electron mass, kinetic term for the photon, kinetic term for the new photon. F prime. And then I'll add this mixing term. And I'm going to put in a half for reasons that will soon be clear. All right, so the reason this is called kinetic mixing is obvious, because if you were to expand each of these out, they're just the kinetic terms for, you know, this looks like half a kinetic term for the photon. This is half a kinetic term for the other dark photon. So really, if you were to just work in this theory without modifying things at all, you'd have to think about propagators where a photon, inverting a propagator where you can have a photon come in and a dark photon come out, which is just kind of nasty. But there's a sensible way of dealing with this, which is to realize that you could just complete the square of these in these two terms and write this as an F tilde mu nu. I'll call it F tilde prime, this is going to have F tilde, or sorry, let me define A tilde prime is going to be A prime mu minus epsilon A mu So now, if I expand this out, the first two terms in the expansion of that kinetic term I just wrote down are precisely these two. I obviously am going to get a third term that I have to subtract off to get the same thing as before, which is nothing but a fourth epsilon squared F mu nu squared. So now if I wanted to get rid of that, I would also have to do a very simple field redefinition of my photon field to be, to be just 1 minus epsilon squared times the original photon field. Now I would have a canonically normalized kinetic term for F. Of course, the effective charge here would be some E tilde, which is E times, this should be to the, is that what you were gonna, okay. Which should be E times the square root of 1 minus epsilon squared. All right, but the only physically observable quantity in that theory, it's very easy to see, is just the effect of electric charge, E tilde. So there's actually, up to now, in this simple Lagrangian, there's no physical effect at all of that mixing, which may make you wonder why I'm bothering to talk about it at all. So there's two things that I can change in this Lagrangian that are pretty reasonable that introduce a physical effect of that dark photon field. I can add dark sector matter. Or I can add a mass for the A prime field. And both of those, in either of those two cases, I will get real physical effects from that kinetic mixing. So let me first add dark sector matter. Let me add just some chi bar d slash minus I g dark a prime mu, sorry, a prime slash chi. And now, when I've done this field redefinition to get to make everything else canonical, what I'll get if I write this in terms of the tilted fields is I'm going to get chi bar d slash minus I g dark. I can write that a prime. I'm going to start dropping these epsilon squared terms because they're really unimportant normalization corrections. So I can solve for a prime as a tilde prime plus epsilon a tilde. So now my gauge coupling for chi looks like this. I haven't substantially changed the interaction with the A prime. It's still just some dark charged object. But now it looks like it's part of the electromagnetic current. So actually chi is millicharged. It's often called millicharged or mini-charged, even though we don't know necessarily what epsilon is. We're just presuming that it's small under electromagnetism. Okay, and so there's actually quite a few constraints on quite a few different systems that you can use to constrain these millicharged particles. But the constraints are kind of shockingly weak. In particular, for m chi greater than about a GeV, the only constraints that we have right now come from LHC detectors. So just to finish this, if I have this epsilon g dark, this means that the effective charge, sort of relative to the electron charge, is going to be g dark epsilon over E. So I'll call that Q effective. For masses larger than about a GeV, the limit on Q effective is that Q effective has to be less than something of order a third. It actually gets even worse at higher masses. The reason for that, you might ask, well, but I mean, 1 GeV, I should be copiously producing that at the LHC. Why is the constraint so weak? Production isn't the problem. Detection is actually the problem. That these weakly charged particles, as they go through, say, the tracking detectors of CMS or Atlas, because they have a smaller charge, all those detectors work by detecting ionization by a charged particle passing through them. And the ionization signal is proportional to Q squared. So something like this would be about a tenth as ionizing as an electron. That's just below the threshold of what the detectors can pick up. And so you basically, you can produce them copiously and still not be sensitive to them at the LHC. I encourage you guys who think that this is a travesty to look at a recent paper by Itai, Eder Izaguirre, Andy Haas, and Chris Sell, which is a pretty cool idea for how to actually see this stuff at the LHC. Below a GeV, the constraints get better. There's some cosmological constraints, basically coming from the fact that you can thermalize the chi in the early universe, and in the process, thermalize this dark photon radiation. When the chi decouples from thermal equilibrium, you're still, the A prime also decouples. And so you're left with this residual bath of dark photons that contribute to the effective number of relativistic degrees of freedom. For heavy chi, that gets diluted enough before BBM that there's no constraint. But for lighter chi, this constraint is pretty good. There's also some dedicated fixed target experiments for MCHI in the sort of few MeV region that were done at SLAC, I think, in the 80s, that give you sensitivity to about 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 3. So that shows that if you can design a clever detector to study them, you can really get, I mean, this is not an impenetrable limit of, you know, human detection capabilities. You can actually do much better. You just need to make sure that you can produce them and detect them in the same environment. Okay, so let me quickly talk about, it'll take me more than 1 minute, but hopefully Matthias will forgive me. Talk about the case of giving the dark photon a mass. So I'm just going to add to my Lagrangian. Just a mass term. Now, this field redefinition that I did over here starts looking kind of silly, because while it may diagonalize the kinetic term, it's going to wreak havoc on the mass term. So there's, in this case, a unique choice of field redefinition that leaves both the mass term and the kinetic terms invariant. And that is to take, and again, I'm going to drop epsilon squared terms. So I'll take the A prime field to stay the same under my field redefinition. That way the mass term stays the same. But my photon field, I'm going to shift by epsilon A prime. Thanks. Yes, minus. Now, I actually could have done this over here too. Right? That would still diagonalize everything. It just would have been a slightly more confusing way to think about the world. Because then instead of thinking about this millicharge coupling to electrons being mediated by a gauge boson we know and love, we would have said in this basis it's mediated by an unfamiliar strange gauge boson. But over here, we're left, you know, we have no choices. If we want to write down a diagonal propagator, this is the set of fields we should use. And when we do that, my dark sector matter, well, its interactions, if I have dark sector matter, aren't going to change substantially. But the electron interactions do change. Now I'm going to end up with exactly the same kind of effect. Kinetic term. The electron that looks like A tilde slash plus epsilon A tilde prime slash. So now electrons are millicharged or epsilon charged. Under this, whatever the dark, this is often called a U1 dark, whatever gauge group it is, whatever I want to call the gauge group, that's gauged by this A prime. Why does that have important consequences? Well, now there's a massive, this is like, you can produce Zs from electrons. Well, you can also produce A primes through similar kinds of interactions. So, for example, in E plus E minus collisions, you have processes like this. There are similar processes that can be important in fixed target collisions, and this is what Matt will lecture about. You can also have processes, if there is a chi in the dark sector, like I wrote over there, then I can have processes that say, let electrons annihilate into that chi, and in fact, chi could be a viable dark matter candidate. That's something I'll talk about this afternoon. All right, so let me just now very briefly tell you, and I won't write any equations for this. I did all of this in toy QED. So you should ask, well, how does this generalize to the standard model? And the answer is that where instead of mixing with the photon, it was mixing with hypercharge. So actually, I will write just one part of an equation. I will tell you that you should think of the kinetic mixing as, so I'm going to have some B mu nu. This is the hypercharge field strength, F prime mu nu, an epsilon. But I can think of the B mu nu in terms of my mass eigenstate fields as a cos theta Weinberg times F mu nu plus a sine theta Weinberg times a Z field strength. And now I'm left with two problems. The first problem, two pieces of a calculation to do. They're not like conceptual problems. First, I've got at the highest mass scales, I need to deal with the fact that my Z is kinetically mixing with the A prime. If the A prime is much lighter than the Z, then that's a lot like this case, but with the roles of the two particles reversed, right? So basically, the Z, I want to keep the mass matrix diagonal. That means I don't want to do much of a big field redefinition on the Z field. I'll do most of my field redefinition on the A prime field. And that means that chi will get a millicharge, or will get an epsilon charge under Z. Now, actually, because the A prime isn't exactly massless, weakly interacting particles, say neutrinos, they won't be completely neutral under the A prime, but they get an epsilon times ma prime squared over mz squared type charge under the A prime. That's from the Z mu nu. A prime and the ZA prime mixing. So any kinds of new interactions you think about for the neutrinos or any other kinds of parity violating interactions you think about mediated by the Z, the results of the ZA prime mixing are still G Fermi suppressed because of this 1 over mz squared factor that's ubiquitous. And now they're also epsilon suppressed. So you get epsilon corrections to these parity violating effects, but they're never enhanced relative to the parity violating effects of the Z itself. The second thing Once I've dealt with that, then I can deal with my A prime photon mixing. And that is just exactly the case that I considered earlier, where electrons and other standard model charged particles get an epsilon charge under the A prime. And if you're careful, of course, this epsilon is accompanied by a cosine theta weak. And this epsilon would be, these two epsilons would be accompanied by a sine theta weak. And so that's the story. So at low energies, so you might be sensitive to this effect if you have dark sector matter. And at low energies, you'd certainly be sensitive to this effect, that there's now a new gauge interaction of the electrons. That's why I said earlier on that that's very, that the effect is very similar to this operator number 3. But I haven't gauged a new symmetry. I'm just adding a new particle that couples to an existing gauge symmetry of the standard model. All right, so that's all I wanted to say this morning. I'm running a couple minutes late, but if people have burning questions, I hope.
Yeah.
Happy to discuss them.
Yeah, we have a few minutes for questions.
Because when you got constraints you mentioned, do they depend on the chi being all of the dark matter?
Over here on the millicharged stuff?
Yes.
These do not. They just rely on, in fact, I wasn't assuming anything about the chi density at all to evaluate these constraints. All I was relying on, I didn't tell you how much abundance of chi there was or whether that was a problem in this parameter space. All I was relying on is that these interactions exist and that the universe was once hot enough to produce these chi's, put them into thermal equilibrium. Right? And the minute you have that, the A prime also goes into thermal equilibrium because it's just some, you know, G dark coupling suppression to produce them. And then as these freeze, as these get colder, eventually that interaction will freeze out and I'll be left with some residual dark photon abundance.
What's the origin of the A prime mass?
Ah, that is a very good question that I didn't have time to include. So you could imagine that there's some Higgs sector that gives rise to it. Also, because it's a U1, you could just write down masses by hand. That's totally consistent with, you know, you get a totally consistent Stueckelberg theory for a massive H boson.
Huh?
So the local U1 forbids a mass term, but if you were to just write down the theory with a mass term, and ask, is there any unitarity problem with this theory? For a U1, there is not. For non-abelian gauge bosons, there is, of course. You have WW scattering that blows up. And that tells you that you need a Higgs mechanism to unitarize the theory. For photons, you don't. There's no photon-photon, no dimensionless photon-photon scattering that would blow up at high energies without a Higgs. This would be a totally consistent theory in its own right that doesn't require any UV completion.
What
words do you want to assign to a gauge symmetry? So for example, I mean, if you really like writing things in a gauge invariant way, you can do a Stueckelberg field redefinition on the dark photon, make it look massless again, and restore the gauge symmetry, and you just have some scalar degree of freedom that transforms under it. The invariant statement is that this theory has one more polarization degree of freedom, one more physical degree of freedom than the analogous theory over here without a mass term, which is the longitudinal mode of the dark photon. That's an invariant statement. You can write that one with or without a gauge symmetry, depending on how you feel like it, because gauge symmetries are really just a redundancy in how you write down the theory. Now, if I had more time, I would tell you a little bit about mechanisms to generate that kind of mass term dynamically. And there's actually some that are very very general, very sort of very natural in the context of supersymmetric theories, that basically if you supersymmetrize the kinetic mixing interaction, and this will hopefully make more sense tomorrow, to those of you who know less supersymmetry, then there's what's called a D-term coupling that relates particles, that basically forces, relates that kinetic mixing term to a mixing term, to a quartic coupling between all scalars that couple to one fermion and to the other fermion. Sorry, to one gauge term, boson and the other gauge boson. I'm really butchering this. In fact, it would give you precisely this Higgs portal type of interaction, where R Higgs is charged under hypercharge, and if there's a dark Higgs, then presumably it's charged under that dark U1. And so in a supersymmetric theory, the kinetic mixing, this F prime, mu nu, B mu nu, is always accompanied by an H squared, phi squared, with a closely related coefficient. And so that can lead to the electroweak symmetry breaking of the standard model inducing a symmetry breaking of the dark sector, which could naturally give you, depending on the initial mass of that phi, could naturally give you a dark sector symmetry breaking. And so then you would, so there are models where you can Higgs this U1 and even relate the scale of that U1, of that dark photon mass, to the scale of kinetic mixing. But it's also totally legitimate as just a free parameter that I write down from the beginning. And I guess the only part of the discussion earlier about the size of epsilon that would change in that case is that in that case, if I just write down a bare mass term for the U1, it is not legitimate to put it into a gut. And so I wouldn't really expect to get this three-loop mixing. But aside from, but only that one parenthetical of the lecture would have to be changed.
Any more questions? So hopefully you'll see some of it in math lecture as well, at least the searches for these. So keep some of this formalism in mind, and we can ask more questions about it after math lecture as well, if there's any learning questions. Okay, so if not, let's thank you for having me.